As many children as possible are treated as...
Welcome to the Doctors Without Borders Médecins Sans Frontières podcast for June 2006. I'm your host, Martin Broughton. Today we'll hear stories from the medical front lines in the Democratic Republic of Congo, northern Kenya and the Palestinian territories, and we'll hear about how an innovative strategy based on new products is transforming the ways acute malnutrition is treated. A severe drought in northern Kenya has worsened the long-term food shortages faced by people in the region, destroying reserves of livestock and leading to an increase of children suffering from acute malnutrition. While recent rains have made some difference, the season ahead may still be difficult for many. Lucy Clayton reports from the northern Kenyan town of El Wak.
El Wak is a small town in the northeast of Kenya, right on the border with Somalia. And like much of the Horn of Africa region, it has been struck recently by a severe drought. Although there has been some rain here recently, large numbers of livestock have died over the past month. And as you drive along the bumpy roads here, you see the carcasses of cows and goats and donkeys and even camels along the wayside. They smell absolutely terrible.
When the time we are expecting the rain, it doesn't rain. So the results, the dams dried up, no pasture, the animal died.
The people who live here are mainly pastoralists, and they live traditionally from the meat and the milk from their animals. Now that many animals have died, food is scarce, and the MSF team here are seeing more and more children who need to be treated for severe malnourishment. Anna Thompson is the nurse running the nutritional program here.
We are admitting all the children that are severely or moderate malnourished. Because of this drought, you can see that the malnutrition has become a bit chronic.
The MSF team here have had to adapt their way of working to fit with the pastoralist way of life. Feeding programs normally require the patients to come to a fixed spot on a regular basis for a medical checkup and for therapeutic feeding. But pastoralists are semi-nomadic. They have to move around with their animals to find pasture for them to graze on, so coming to one fixed spot and staying in one place is very hard for them. The MSF solution is to go out to them rather than asking them to come to us.
We go out one day per week to a different location, and then we see the children there and we assess the children if they have any medical complaints. And for the ones that are severely ill or if they have dropped weight, we refer them and we take them back in the car with us. And most common is diarrhea or respiratory tract infection.
Today we are going to Ouargadou to see the children. People who are living with cattle, they always have to give first priority to their cattle. If the grazing areas are far away, where there's green bushes and water for the cattle, they have to move, no matter how malnourished their children are.
Surviving. We're a bit late. We had an emergency this morning, so I hope they will still be there waiting.
And we call them by name. This is one of the ones we found in Alongo. And she's been coming every week here since then. She was so sick when we found her. She had a really bad chest infection.
As many children as possible are treated as outpatients. They are weighed each week and given a week's ration of a therapeutic food called Plumpy Nut.
Plumpy Nuts is the food that we give to the children in our program. It's a peanut paste. It contains 500 kilocalories, one bag, and it contains a good amount of proteins, a balance with the nutrients, and also iron.
Yes, the little girl.
6.2, at least she has no fever now, yeah?
Okay.
We'll give her 1 week. I'm worried about it's not gaining.
If kids are not gaining weight on the program, or if they have medical complications, they have to be taken to the MSF Therapeutic Feeding Centre back in El Wak for 24-hour intensive care. Adan and Fatima Hassan are two MSF staff working at the Therapeutic Feeding Centre.
We admitted this week last week. Now I want to give us a bowl of rest for the diarrhea. And we will see the antibiotics for the test.
Unfortunately, the team sometimes sees children coming back to the intensive care unit again and again. Whilst they're being treated there with 24-hour care, they put on weight. But once they're discharged and go home, their parents share out the child's food rations with their other hungry children.
There's a problem of sharing the front nuts within the other children who are at home. This is actually understandable because there's really anything to eat back at home. This makes it difficult for the child to gain the right weight expected because the children and the whole family shares the plant peanuts, and they may have one or two children in the program out of seven or eight children who are in the family.
The MSF team here are now stepping up their work with a wider food distribution for about 15,000 more children. However, it's clear that this will only provide a temporary solution. Determined investment in healthcare by the government is going to be crucial to tackling this problem in the long term.
In the past, severely malnourished children were kept for up to a month in feeding centres. A new strategy of treating uncomplicated forms of acute malnutrition on an outpatient basis with new therapeutic foods has proven incredibly effective and holds the promise of treating exceptionally large numbers of affected children. Here's Kevin Phelan discussing these innovations with nutrition specialist Dr. Milton Tectonides.
Dr. Milton Tectonides, nutritional specialist for Médecins Sans Frontières MSF in Paris. Now, maybe you could describe the new strategy for treating acute malnutrition.
The new strategy is basically depends on making a distinction between complicated and uncomplicated acute malnutrition and treating all uncomplicated cases as outpatients. In other words, where they only have to come periodically to receive their food and get a checkup. And only the complicated cases have to be hospitalized. That's the basis of the new strategy. And the new strategy has been made possible because we have new products. So it's just a solid form of a therapeutic milk that's made from nutrient-dense products like peanuts and powdered milk, to which are added what is missing to make a full therapeutic diet. These products work spectacularly in helping children put on rapid weight gain.
There has been some attention paid to Plumpy Nut, the peanut butter paste that we use widely in a lot of our projects. Are there other products like this on the horizon?
Many options are possible to make this type of product. It's the end formula that's important in terms of specific quantities of energy, protein, lipid, and micronutrients. So the two commercial products are BP100 and Plumpy Nut, and Valid International, an agency that's been heavily invested in these new products, has come up with different recipes and is actually producing them in places like Ethiopia or Bangladesh, where they use for local foods, for example, chickpeas, and they add what is necessary to make it into to give the same final formula. So hopefully this will expand. These type of products, the number and availability of these products and their cost will encourage people to use them more. And I think it's certainly possible to reduce the cost of the production of these products.
Can you give me an example of a response to malnutrition in the past? I'm remembering Angola in 2002.
Well, in the past, all severe acute malnutrition was treated on an inpatient basis. And in big emergencies, that meant therapeutic feeding centers, which really started in the 80s. So big structures with many staff working 24 hours a day, cooking meals almost all day long. And, of course, there were limited capacity, even in the big, big, huge emergencies. We were overwhelmed in Somalia, overwhelmed in Sudan in 98. There was too many children, and there was no way we could make enough of a structure to hold them all.
And last year in Niger represented a huge expansion of our ability to treat acute malnutrition.
Even in 2003, the system was working, and by 2004, the system was working very well. In 2005, two things happened. The usual situation of food insecurity got much, much worse, so malnutrition rates went much higher, and MSF expanded operations, so the number of patients we treated was much higher. But essentially, the system was in place by 2004. So all in all sections together treated something like 63,000 children. In Maradi, the biggest region, almost 40,000 admissions.
Now, on a global scale, Malnutrition is implicated in almost 10 million deaths a year around the world. Is this the type of strategy that can be implemented on a wide scale?
This is happening in numerous countries, and several governments have started using these products in their own type of similar programs that are, in other words, trying to integrate this new idea in Ethiopia and Malawi. And of course, the real big challenge is that it's not in big emergencies where MSF will be able to do more and more. It will be for countries which have high levels of malnutrition to use these products to treat acute malnutrition themselves. Where many of the clinical nutritionists are at, they're convinced that micronutrient deficiencies are the source of most of growth failure and malnutrition in childhood, and not infant and young child feeding practices. As much as access to health, access to clean water, and care practices are important, we will see that by improving the diversity and quality of children's diets, especially amongst poor rural populations, it will reverse malnutrition on a huge scale.
So, in a sense, you're saying increase their choices for some of these ready-to-use therapeutic products.
In a country like India, where incomes are higher than in a country like Sierra Leone, it might be possible for parents like us, in our countries, to purchase products that are for their child, that are specifically designed for their child. At the moment, those type of products exist. They're in our markets. There's hundreds of them, these type of weaning age foods. People purchase them because they know they've been recommended by their doctors to use these foods as they wean their children. And these exist, but most of them are way too expensive for the average person in India, and they are mostly only available in large urban markets. So what we need is some sort of equivalent that can be purchased by people who are slightly with lesser revenues and perhaps provided to those who are extremely poor and destitute.
General elections are scheduled in the Democratic Republic of Congo for July 2006. While preparations for the vote are underway in the capital Kinshasa, tens of thousands of violently displaced people in the southeastern province of Katanga are torn between remaining in camps and taking the risk of returning to their villages. Here's Derek Williams with this report, produced by Svenja Kunyal in Katanga.
We're approaching the village Dubié by plane. Until recently, it had around 10,000 inhabitants, but at the end of last year, an influx of internally displaced people saw the population of this village in the Congolese province of Katanga increase almost threefold in just a few weeks. The displaced live in shelters made of straw or plastic sheeting, most of which are around 6 square meters in size and accommodate up to 10 people. There are long rows of these makeshift huts huddled closely together in three camps in Dubié and the surrounding area.
On avait brûlé des enfants et des grandes personnes. On prend un arbre.
They burned children and grown-ups. People were beaten to death. We saw it, even children.
Même des enfants.
Says owner de Kabila Otondo, recalling the day her village was attacked. She now lives in one of the camps with her four children and is afraid to go back to her village, just like Ono de Julie Mboye.
We can't go back. They could kill us as well.
Only taking what she was able to carry, she fled from her village to Dubié in November to escape bloody fighting between government troops and rebels. Her daughter Mboye Jolie is lying in her arms. She's severely malnourished, has edemas, and is in a lot of pain. She's being treated with nutrient-rich milk at the Médecins Sans Frontières feeding center. Ronald Kremer, male nurse in Dubié.
I arrived in February, and at that moment we had a TFC, a therapeutic feeding center, with around 70 children. The nutritional status of the people and the children was really terrible. And we had mortality numbers of 22, 25, 28%. And that's a disaster.
The number of children being treated in the feeding center has now dropped dramatically. Since April, Médecins Sans Frontières has been handing out flour, beans, and oil to the displaced. Every month, 17 truckloads of food amounting to around 130 tons make the journey along dusty tracks from the capital of the province, Lubumbashi, to Dubié. While the issue of malnutrition appears to have been resolved for the time being, the start of the dry season poses new health risks. There's likely to be a shortage of clean water in the next few weeks, and the makeshift huts offer little protection from the lower nighttime temperatures. The mobile clinics perform some 100 consultations every day. Severine Equilouze, head of mission.
Your respiratory infections are increasing, and then are the classical sickness like diarrhea. We also notice a quite high level of sexually transmitted infections. And the first killer, I think, remains malaria, and especially for children less than 5.
Lack of space, hunger, disease. Many of the displaced would like to return to their villages, rebuild their houses, and till the fields again, because incidents of fighting are now few and far between. Camp inhabitant Jean-Pierre Mukalai.
Some families have already left the camps because of the hunger. They don't know what to expect when they get back home.
Dr. Maria Overbeck is familiar with the region that many of the refugees are returning to, and she and her team have set up a small healthcare center in the village of Shamwara.
Yeah, there's a huge lack of everything. So there's lack of healthcare, there's water and sanitation, there are no schools, there is no employment, there is nothing. It is probable that there are more areas where a population has to live under similarly deplorable conditions like in Shamwana.
President Joseph Kabila gave his word that things would change when he visited the region recently. He made promises of new roads, schools, and hospitals if he were to win the elections on July 30th. But more than anything, all the refugees want at the moment is a sense of security. Severine Equilouze.
They want very basic thing, to be able to grow their children and to send them to school and just to live in peace and quietly without facing violence and to be able to remain with their family and in their village. No big dreams.
The recent cutting of Western aid to the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority and the continuing violence has deepened the challenges faced by residents in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. MSF has been working in the Palestinian territories since 1989 and is trying to adapt its programs to the worsening situation on the ground. Michael Goldfarb has this report.
An uncertain future lies ahead for health services in the West Bank and Gaza in the wake of the Western funding cut to the Palestinian Authority. Laura Brav is head of mission for MSF programs in the Palestinian territories, which focus primarily on mental health. She spoke to us from the West Bank town of Nablus.
With Hamas winning the election and the consequent decision of the donors to suspend all funds to any of the Palestinian Authority ministries, any plans with regard to setting up new mental health or other types of projects obviously are completely frozen. At this point, it's really impossible to predict the future as we're having to readapt our way of working on an almost weekly basis as the situation evolves.
As militants fire rockets into Israel, Palestinians living in the north of the Gaza Strip are vulnerable to retaliatory shelling by the Israeli army. The challenges and stresses of living in a war zone are immense, and medical needs sometimes go unmet.
It's been extremely difficult for us to reach those patients, the ones most affected by the shelling in the north, who are some of the ones that are not being talked about very much, because although the media covers it when a shell actually lands on a civilian home or like the incident on the beach, when people are killed, the media covers it, but what they don't cover very much are the approximately 200 families who live really just on the edge of the shelling zones and whose homes are touched by fragments of shells. The people living in those zones are directly affected by the shelling almost every time that it's taking place. From the medical point of view, a lot of these people are too frightened to leave their home because they're worried something will happen to the house or the children while they're gone. So they haven't been going to the clinics. They will go to a hospital if there's a critical injury or medical need, but they won't go to clinics just for basic consultations. So our doctor has been doing kind of primary healthcare consultations in these areas, which are more or less enclaves because of the shelling, making it very difficult for people to leave their homes.
Meanwhile, as conditions slowly worsen, stopgap measures to address humanitarian needs may in the long run prove insufficient.
It's an overall slow deterioration of the situation because they have coping mechanisms and solidarity systems. And on the medical side, for instance, different countries or NGOs have been able to make donations. Hospitals help each other out if one is in shortage of something that another one has. But we're definitely extremely concerned that this kind of piecemeal support can't continue forever. We are hoping that at least on the medical supply side, a solution might be found, because most people seem to agree that medicine should be exempt from sanctions. But so far, there is really no solution in sight. But even if that solution is found, the employees of the hospitals and the clinics haven't been paid for more than 4 months. Most of them really accept to continue working for free. Unfortunately, some of them have told us that they will have to stop coming to work because they can't even pay for the transport to go to work anymore.
Thank you for listening to the June 2006 Médecins Sans Frontières podcast. Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, is an independent medical humanitarian aid organization that delivers emergency assistance to people affected by wars, epidemics, and natural or man-made disasters in more than 70 countries around the world. For more information about these stories, as well as updates on other underreported humanitarian emergencies, please visit our websites, either at doctorswithoutborders.org or msf.org.